Caldecott medalist Brian Selznick is a storyteller at heart. A talented and in-demand illustrator, Selznick has recently come into his own as a writer. His new book, Wonderstruck, makes good use of both abilities, telling two stories side by side, one in words and the other in pictures. Selznick won the Caldecott Medal for Illustration in 2007 for his illustrated novel The Invention of Hugo Cabret, and Wonderstruck builds on that format. It's a book of wonders, taking readers into mysterious places and secret rooms. With a lightning bolt on the cover and this quote from Gregory Maguire inside the jacket, "Sooner or later, lightning comes to us all." I asked Selznick if the idea for Wonderstruck hit him suddenly.
I was struck very slowly by lightning for this book. It was about 3 years of working on this book and an idea that I originally had probably 10 or 15 years earlier. But I was I'm a huge fan of Gregory Maguire's, and I love his books. And I was listening to an audio version of his work. And when I was listening to A Lion Among Men and I heard that line of text from the end of the book, I thought that it would be perfect since lightning is such an important part of the story. And I actually had the title of the book before I had the plot. And so I knew I had to have someone struck with something, since the title was going to be Wonderstruck and lightning seemed to make sense. And it sort of carried on from there.
Wow, like St. Paul on the road to Damascus.
I was converted. yeah, I had used the word Wonderstruck in my very first book in 1991, The Houdini Box, and I had been trying to find a word to describe how people felt about Houdini, and excited and thrilled never seemed quite right. And I found a thesaurus from the 20s and discovered the word Wonderstruck. So I had the title early on. I had the structure of the book where I knew I wanted to tell one story with words and one story with pictures. And so because I had the title Wonderstruck, I knew that that lightning would make sense as part of the plot. And then because so much of the book is about that sense of being literally struck with wonder and of that sort of great change, or that kind of great inspiration, and having that sort of wonder fill your life in certain ways, it all sort of made sense at the time as I was putting the plot together.
So how did you develop the story from there? While it features deaf characters, it isn't necessarily about deaf culture.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very important part of the story. And I knew that the characters were going to be deaf early on. One of the things that I was trying to figure out was why I was going to tell a story just with pictures. Because in my previous book, The Invention of Hugo Cabret, I tell one story going back and forth between text and sequences of pictures, because I wanted that book to feel like a movie. I wanted it to feel cinematic since it has something to do with the history of movies. But for the new book, I wanted to experiment with something different and try to tell two different stories, one just with words and one just with pictures. But I needed to find a justification for the use of pictures. Why would I tell a story just with images? And I remembered a documentary that I had seen called Through Deaf Eyes on PBS while I was working on Hugo. And it was about the history of deaf culture and deaf education. And there were a couple parts of the documentary that really struck me. One, an interview with a young deaf man who talked about how it wasn't until he went to college and met other deaf people that he realized he was part of this larger community and a larger culture. And the idea of being part of a community or a culture outside of your biological family was really interesting to me. And there was also a section about the transition from silent to sound movies and what a tragedy that was for the deaf community, because it for the first time meant that they couldn't enjoy the main popular culture of cinema along with hearing audiences. And there was a quote from a deaf educator that said that the deaf are the people of the eye, which I think has something to do with the fact that sign language is a visual language that you watch and look at to understand. And so I thought maybe it would be interesting to tell the story of a deaf person with pictures so that the way their story is told in some way echoes the way they might experience their life. And so that's where the deafness and the idea of exploring deafness started. But really, it's the story of two kids who run away to New York. The two stories take place 50 years apart, one in the 70s and one in the 20s. And so the main thing was writing about individuals who you know, who run away to New York in search of something and someone important to them.
Do you best communicate through words or through pictures?
I definitely think in pictures. I feel like I communicate much better in pictures. Words still feel a little bit like a foreign language when I have to translate images into text. So when I'm making up stories, I tend to think of them visually, but then I start everything by writing what I want the text, what I want the pictures to be, what I want the stories to be. I think about the plot first, and I'm able to draw much faster, I think, because I was trained to draw my whole life. But when it's time to sit down and really write the prose for the text in my books, I tend to overwrite because I'm describing everything I see in my head. And so Tracy Mack, my editor at Scholastic, is really good about editing down everything I'm writing so that it distills the text down into something that is so that the words are necessary. I guess that's ultimately, you know, sort of what the goal is. And so I, as you might be able to tell as I stumble through this answer, that pictures are easier for me than words.
Well, what do you think the difference is for people reading pictures as opposed to words? Maybe more room for imagination?
Well, I definitely think that it uses different parts of your brain. But one of the things I do want is for people to really feel like they have to read the pictures. I think we tend to take pictures and images for granted, and you can look at a complicated image and instantaneously feel like you've brought in all of the information, that you've taken it all in, and that you understand it. But of course, you really haven't. You have to stop and you have to spend time with the images to really understand them. And so the words, I feel like we slow down in a way when we're reading text in a way that we generally don't when we're looking at images. And so one of the things I like to play with these books is hoping that the reader is reminded to slow down and look at the pictures and read the pictures in a way that is parallel with how they are reading the story. Because in Wonderstruck, I've essentially made three books. I have a book that's written all in text about a boy in 1977 that has to work by itself from front to back. And then I have another book about a girl in 1927 that's told just with pictures, and that has to work front to back. And then there's the book that's created by the weaving together of those two stories. And that's where the reader is asked to do a lot of work, because you have things from both stories echoing each other. And so it's almost like the interconnection of those two stories creates a third book. And that's the place that's most interesting to me. What happens in the reader's mind as these two stories weave back and forth.
And are children more adept at reading pictures than adults?
I think that it might be true. I think that kids are very open to whatever is put in front of them because everything is new. And so when I was making The Invention of Hugo Cabré, I really didn't know if kids would be able to make sense of a story that's told partially with words and then partially with these long picture sequences. So I wrote a whole introduction that says, you know, welcome to the story. Basically, this is what you're going to see. If you're going to meet this boy, Hugo Cabré, follow him through the train station. And then you see pictures of him in the train station and you're following him just like the text said. But then the pictures start going other places that you weren't told about. And so it's like I'm taking your hand into the book and helping you know how to read it. But with Wonderstruck, you start off, there's a little preamble with some pictures of wolves running towards you, but then you have about 20 pages of text about this boy who's lost his mother in 1977, and suddenly you turn the page and it says Hoboken, New Jersey, 1927, and you're thrust rather suddenly into a completely different story, completely different time period, a completely different way of telling the story. But it's been very gratifying to talk to kids who get it right away and are very open to these somewhat strange structures and these somewhat unusual topics for kids, because, you know, Hugo was about French silent movies, which isn't necessarily something that you would think kids would like, and Wonderstruck has a lot of things in it that people usually don't encounter till often till they're in college, things about the history of museums and cabinets of wonder and quotes from Oscar Wilde and all these things, but it's hopefully put in a context that makes sense for kids.
Wonderstruck tells two stories. One set in 1977 follows a young boy named Ben to New York City as he tries to find his father. The other is about a mysterious girl named Rose in 1927. Ben's story is told in words, and Rose's story is told entirely in pictures. Finding out how the two stories come together in the end is one of the pleasures of this remarkable book.
I developed both of the plots together, so I knew that there were going to be moments where both parts of the stories connected in certain ways. For instance, Ben is in a lightning storm in 1977. There's the lightning again. And I really wanted to draw lightning, but Ben's story is told all with text. So the only way to draw lightning was if there was lightning in Rose's story at around the same moment in the structure of the book. But I didn't want to just have her in a lightning storm too, and so I thought maybe she goes to a movie theater and sees lightning on the screen in a movie. But then I had to figure out why she would go to a movie in the middle of her story. And so I thought, well, maybe she's into some actress. So I made up a silent movie actress named Lillian Mayhew. But then I thought, well, why is she into this actress? And the more I thought about it, the more central it became to Rose's story, until it became the central part of her plot, and all of that happened because I wanted to draw lightning. And so I developed both stories, but I finished Rose's plot and I finished all of Rose's drawings about 9 or 10 months before I finished Ben's text. And so there was a huge amount of change that was going on with Ben's story right up to the very end of the process of making the book, and the book was like going out to the printer, and I was still making last minute changes, and the copy editors were noticing little tiny things that we had to fix, and Ben's story was really to the very end we were working on it, and Rose's story had really been completed much earlier.
Rose's story has a melodrama that is not in Ben's story. Is that the effect of the silent film?
Yeah, I definitely wanted the feeling of silent film to come through. And, you know, of course, the cinema was really important to the invention of Hugo Cabret. And it's less important here in terms of the plot, but there is an element that's very important to Rose's story that does have to do with the silent movies and the cinema and melodrama. And so I thought it would be fun to play with that idea for her plot as well, and to see how that could weave into Ben's story in 1977, you know, and he ends up in New York City in the heat wave of 1977, and you couldn't get farther in certain ways from the world of the 1927 melodramas, but it was fun to try to weave them together.
And the dramatic aspect of the pictures, what you drew and how you framed it, is what makes Rose so mysterious.
Yeah, I wanted the elements of Rose's life to slowly reveal themselves as you are reading the story. So, for instance, it's not made clear. There's no indication that Rose is deaf for probably a quarter of her story. So if you just pick up the book and don't know anything about it, you're just following this girl who's writing strange, mysterious notes and sending them off into the world and running away to the movie theater. And there's a lot of elements that are hopefully intriguing and mysterious, but it's not until you know, certain revelations come about in the pictures that the things that you've previously seen begin to make sense. And so that's why it's important to pay attention to all of the details in the pictures. There are postcards and other clues all around the drawings to let us know things about her. And I also wanted to give her a name that I could also draw. So that's why I came up with the name of Rose, because before you might notice what her name is from the drawings, she has a rose in her hair. She has a rose decoration painted on the head of her bed. There are roses everywhere. And so it's not necessarily something that you would pick up but immediately, but I wanted those visual clues to be there.
Should have named her Tulip. It's a lot easier to draw.
I wish I had talked to you a couple months ago.
Adam Gopnik wrote of Wonderstruck in the New York Times, "For Selznick, the beauty of strangeness, more than its management, is the purpose of storytelling. And though some of his questions are answered, his mysteries remain intact." Is there a sense of mystery that you try to retain in your stories?
Well, I think that mystery is sort of the central thing that I'm concerned with. And I love the idea that there's something that we don't understand, there's something that we can't understand, but that makes us feel connected to something larger. I mean, it almost becomes connected to certain ideas about religion or where how people feel that they fit into something larger. But it's not a religious feeling. It's an idea that we are connected and there's something magical, you know. And I'm really interested in things that feel magical without there actually being magic. So I really want my stories to feel like there's an element of magic, because so many times when I'm working on books, when I'm working on stories, strange coincidences happen, weird things happen that make me feel like I'm connected to something larger and that I'm, you know, working on the right project. And I think that, you know, that element of mystery is incredibly important and exciting. You know, I once did a book about Eleanor Roosevelt and Amelia Earhart, and I had always been a fan of Amelia Earhart's, and I know people are always trying to, you know, find out what happened to her and, you know, figure out where she actually is. But part of what makes the story so beautiful for those of us who weren't personally, her family, it was a tragedy that she disappeared. But part of the ongoing power of the story is that we don't know. And I think it's really important that we remember that it's important not to know some things.
And what better setting for wonder than the American Museum of Natural History in New York City?
Mm. Yeah, I've always loved the Museum of Natural History. My parents, we were raised in New Jersey. My parents hated New York. And so we very rarely went in, but one of the only times we did go in was to the museum. And I lived on the Upper West Side for a long time, a couple blocks away from the museum, and so I would just wander the halls. And it's a really, really wonderful, mysterious, strange place. And, you know, you've got those dioramas that are so brilliantly crafted by these incredible artists that you, you know, really feel like you're looking out into these frozen moments around the world that most of us never actually get to visit. And it's a really great place to visit. And my boyfriend, David Serlin, is a professor at the University of California in San Diego, and he taught a class on the history of museums and traced the history of museums back to cabinets of wonder and the collections that people had in the 15th and 16th centuries to show off the wonders of God and the wonders of man, and then traced it back even earlier than that to memory palaces that people used to build in their minds to memorize long tracts of information. And people would create this architecture, this imaginary architecture, and fill it with very strange objects that were sort of mnemonic devices to help people remember things. And in certain ways, these memory palaces eventually were turned into physical spaces that you could walk into. And that history was really, really intriguing to me, and I wanted to try to touch on that as I was looking at the history of museums in the book.
The Cabinet of Wonders. I've always wanted my show to be a Cabinet of Wonders.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that what it is? I mean, and that's what our lives are. Like, you know, when you think about how we collect experiences, how we collect physical objects, you know, I think most people collect something in some way. You know, how we curate our objects in our homes, our clothes, you know, how we display things on our body. You know, life in so many ways is reflected in this idea of a cabinet of wonders. And I think I first heard about cabinets of wonder when I read the amazing book by Lawrence Wexler called Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonders about the Museum of Jurassic Technology in Los Angeles, which is essentially a museum about the experience of being in a museum. So you go in and you see these displays like a quote-unquote real museum, but there's a display about an ant, you know, that has this strange spore that it inhales and a spike grows out of its head, and it's like a natural history diorama. And there's something right next to it about a bat that can fly through lead. And then there's something about Noah's Ark. And as you're walking through, you're beginning to think, I don't know what in this museum is real and what isn't real. And Lawrence Wexler had stumbled upon the museum, and the book is an exploration of exactly that, what's real, what's not real, and what is a museum. And I think that became a really important central motif for the story.
Man, this continues to be a good theme. I mean, Terry Gilliam did a movie a couple of years ago that was sort of like this, where you enter a little space and go into, you know, other lands, other spaces.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what a Cabinet of Wonders is designed to do. It's, you know, you've got all these little shelves, all these little drawers, all these little tiny doors, and each one opens, and inside an object represents something much larger than itself. And so the idea of, you know, going into other worlds, and, you know, Terry Gilliam is obviously the perfect person to make a film about what it would be like to really go into a Cabinet of Wonders.
What kind of research did you do about the Natural History Museum for both Ben and Rose's stories?
In the early 90s, a friend of mine named Sean Murtha got a job at the Museum of Natural History painting diorama backgrounds and building displays. And he brought me behind the scenes to the workshop to see where all the work gets done. And it was like a revelation for me. It was just incredible to see all of the plaster casts and where the, you know, the artificial leaves get made for the plants and different displays, and all the vials and things in glass and shelves of things that aren't on display. Because in any museum, what you see on display is maybe 3% of what they own. And so there's, you know, an endless amount of stuff in storage. So I got to go through all these back hallways. And I remember back then thinking, you know, this would be a great place to set a story. You know, and a couple years later, the movie Night in the Museum came out. And at first I was worried that it meant I wouldn't be able to do my story. But I finally saw the movie, and it's very cute and very funny, but very different than what I was doing. But I spent a lot of time going back to the Museum of Natural History. They have a library there with an incredible photo archive of all of the halls and different exhibitions over the years. So I was able to pull photographs from the 20s and the 70s. And I talked to people who worked at the museum. I talked to an artist named Deidre Scherer, whose father, Fred, had been an artist during the golden age of the creation of the dioramas in the 50s. And so she told me about growing up in the museum, essentially, and being able to play inside the dioramas as they were being built. And so it was these conversations with people who were there. It was other books I read. Steve Quinn, who is at the museum, wrote an incredible book about the dioramas called Windows on Nature. And he talks about all of the artists who made each of the dioramas. There's beautiful photographs of each of them. And so that was a huge help. And then I worked really closely from the photographs that I pulled from the 20s. And then there's a lot of things in the museum that are still on display from the 20s. Like, for instance, this giant, I don't know, it's like 2-foot-tall wax model of a mosquito. It's a very upsetting giant mosquito. And so I, you know, went to the museum and photographed that myself and used that for a moment in the book where Rose encounters the mosquito as she's making her way through the museum.
And you can't write a book about a boy sleeping in a museum and not think of E.L. Konigsberg's From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler.
Yes, that's sort of the text of all running away to a museum stories. And I've always loved that book, and I've always loved the idea. As soon as you hear about that book and the idea of running away to a museum, you can't ever go to a museum again without imagining where you would sleep and what would be the most comfortable and what you would do when everybody was gone. So Wonderstruck is filled with references to From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler. There are names from the book. There are certain plot elements. The E in E.L. Konigsberg stands for Elaine, so I gave one of the characters the name of Elaine. I think there's about 6 or 7 different direct references as a small way of saying thank you to E.L. Konigsberg for the inspiration that her book provided.
And you dedicated this book to Marie Sendak, the author of, among many other fabulous works, Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah, which was a book I'd never really read as a kid, but I rediscovered it when I got a job as a bookseller at Eeyore's Books for Children. And I think if you want to learn about the art of children's books and you want to see what this genre can do, the only book you have to look at is Where the Wild Things Are. It's the perfect picture book. It's a brilliant, stunning work of art. The story, the pictures, the structure of the book, the psychology of the book, everything works together to tell the story of this boy, Max. And I had the great good fortune of meeting Maurice a couple of years ago, and we've become friends. And at a particularly low point, I was feeling frustrated, and I was talking to Maurice. And he said, Brian, you just have to make the book that you want to make. And that single comment led to the invention of Hugo Cabret, and then, of course, that led to Wonderstruck, and I wanted to acknowledge my love for Maurice and my gratitude for his friendship and for all of his wise words, and so I was very happy to dedicate the book to him.
In 2007, Selznick won the Caldecott Medal for Illustration for his book The Invention of Hugo Cabret. Weighing in at almost 3 pounds, the book is over 500 pages and full of beautifully detailed illustrations, not a likely candidate for a bestseller and runaway hit.
When I was working on Hugo, I had no idea that it was going to be successful. It was told in this weird style with the words and the pictures. Like I said before, it's about French silent movies, which, you know, is not a guaranteed bestseller. And so It was a great and wonderful surprise that the book, you know, had the success that it's had. And I was very aware of the fact that when I made Hugo, no one was looking forward to it. You know, I had a very good career before Hugo, but Hugo kind of built its own excitement. But then I knew that because of the excitement around Hugo, that people would be looking forward to Wonderstruck in a way that I had not experienced before. And so there was some fear, but basically when I sit down at my desk and it's time to, you know, take the blank piece of paper and come up with a new story, that's, you know, really the only thing that matters. And so I had, you know, a certain amount of fear over my shoulder. There was a certain amount of awareness that, you know, probably no matter what I did, it, you know, people would say, well, you know, it's not as good as Hugo. But my goal when I'm making a book for myself is to try to make something better and different than the book I made before. I don't mean that I want people to think, other people or readers to think that it's better. It's like, I want to think that what I've done is better and I want to do something different. And I loved what I learned writing and illustrating The Invention of Hugo Cabret. I loved trying to tell a story with pictures in that way. And so when I came up with the idea to tell these two different stories with words and different one with pictures, from the beginning, I really liked the idea of that structure. And it was much harder. I mean, I thought there was nothing harder than Hugo. Like, I had a really difficult time making that book. But as I was making Wonderstruck, and because it's three, you know, essentially three different books that I'm making, it was much harder to put Wonderstruck together. And so the time at my desk was spent with me feeling invigorated by the excitement of this new format, of the stories I was telling, of the research I was doing, learning about deafness and deaf culture and learning about museums and traveling and, you know, doing the research I was doing. But it was, you know, it was basically the same feeling I had when I was working on Hugo, which is, I don't know if anyone's going to like this. I don't know if anyone's going to understand what I'm doing, but I'm excited by it. And so that excitement sort of keeps me going through all the parts that are really frustrating and difficult and in the end, it's my job. And so, you know, I try to keep the excitement around, you know, Hugo over to the side and focus just on the work of making what became Wonderstruck.
Right. So you want to do something better, but you deliberately chose a much more challenging project and increasing the possibility that you could fail.
Yeah.
I mean, what, can't you just take the success of Hugo and coast? Son of Hugo?
Hugo 2. Hugo 2, Electric Boogaloo. No, I couldn't. You know, I just felt like the structure of Hugo, the pictures of Hugo grew out of what the plot was. And the idea of doing the same thing again just was not possible. I don't think I could have physically done it. It would have bored me. It would have depressed me. And so that's the problem is that it means you can always fail. You know, that's exactly the key to it. But it's that fear of failure, I think, and that terror during the course of the creation of the project that I think might mean you're on the right track. You know, like when I was feeling worst while I was working on Wonderstruck, I kept trying to remind myself that this is exactly how bad I felt when I was making Hugo, and that turned out okay. So maybe that's an indication that things will turn out okay, but it does mean a lot of time feeling scared.
There are connections. The silent film. Ben and Rose both feel like outsiders at home and need to find just one other like person. Hugo's looking for a friend. Some of this is important to you?
Yeah, you know, it's perhaps we could say these are issues that are important to me. And it's not that I sit down in the beginning and try to necessarily figure out what the themes are going to be, but it's I put my plots together pretty mechanically. It feels like I'm piecing together a giant machine. And I don't know what the machine is, I don't know what the parts are, but I know certain elements of the machinery, and so I have to get to that one specific place, and I have to then make sense of how the plot gets there, and then the character sort of develops out of the theme. And as I was writing Wonderstruck, I definitely was aware that there were certain things that were coming up again that had come up with Hugo. And, you know, one of the interesting things that happened after I finished Hugo was a reader said to me, you know, that they really loved that the book was all about Hugo creating a new family for himself. And of course, I knew that that's what happened because I wrote the plot and I made it happen. But I had never really thought about the idea that that's what the book was about. And my friend Dan Herlin, who's a theater artist, says that it's the artist's job to make the work, and it's the audience's job to tell them what it's about. And so I've really tried to take that to heart and just make the plot that I need to make, and then sort of see what comes up out of it. And so, you know, there's even, you know, certain plot points that are similar in the two books, like, you know, Ben ends up hiding behind the walls of a very large, important institution that in certain ways echoes things, you know, where Hugo was hiding in the train stations. But I felt like the stories I was telling were different enough that it made sense to just let these elements come through. And I think that, you know, finding your own family, finding someone who you are connected to, finding someone who you spiritually, you know, mysteriously feel connected to, that you're part of a larger community. You know, the ideas of deafness that I was talking about before, about the young man who didn't meet any other deaf people till he was, you know, in college and found out he was part of this larger community. You know, I think that there's something there that echoes with anybody, you know, in so many ways. We grow up and then eventually move out into the world and have to find our community and the people who are like us. So it was interesting to me as I was writing the book that these themes came up and came up even stronger than they did in Hugo, but it was something that I was really happy to explore.
Come November, the name Selznick will be back on the big screen.
Yes, David O. Selznick was my grandfather's first cousin, and he produced Gone with the Wind and King Kong, and I grew up loving the fact that I could see my last name at the beginning of all these movies. And when I got the phone call saying that Martin Scorsese wanted to direct a movie version of Hugo, after I picked myself up off of the floor from the shock of it, I was really thrilled to think about the fact that the name Selznick would be there back on the screen again. And you know, it's been such an amazing process to watch it all unfold and to see Scorsese make this movie and to visit the set and to see how respectful they all were about the original book. From Scorsese to every single person on the crew, they all read the book, they all had the book, they all knew the book inside out and did their best to make us a version of my story that feels like it has to exist on the screen. Because I made a book that, even though it's an homage to the cinema, it was made to feel like it has to exist as a book, where you open the cover and turn the pages and the book itself becomes part of the plot at the end of the story. And, you know, sort of the magic trick that Scorsese has done with his cast and crew is make that same story into something that feels like it absolutely has to be a movie. And I just saw it for the first time, and it's one of the most beautiful films I've seen. And there was the thrill, of course, of knowing it was based on a story I made up. But then there was the thrill of watching an artist as brilliant as Scorsese take that and make it his own, you know, because it's great to make artwork, but it's, in a way, it's even greater to inspire another artist, to inspire someone else to do something that maybe they otherwise wouldn't have done. And, you know, it was just, it was really amazing.
Are you tempted to maybe make films yourself?
You know, I was on that set, and I the first movie set I was ever on was a movie set of Martin Scorsese's, and I saw Martin Scorsese run this set. I saw the hundreds and hundreds of people relying on him and his decisions, and all the brilliant, these were all the best people making movies working together. And I thought to myself, I don't ever, ever want to make a movie. I'm a bookmaker. I love making books. I love writing. I love drawing. And I love the idea that something I made could, like I said, could inspire someone like Scorsese, and to have something of this scale happen from something I made is thrilling. And, you know, if anyone wants to make a movie again, you know, out of something I've done, you know, there's some talk about making a film out of Wonderstruck. That's very exciting to me. I love the idea of being involved in terms of, you know, coming and seeing what's happening, maybe talking about the script a little bit. But I'm not a director. I'm not a filmmaker. I come from a family of filmmakers, and I'm very proud of that. And I'm proud that I'm related to David O. Selznick, and I'm proud to have been able to see what Martin Scorsese did. But if anything, being on the set reinforced for me the fact that I love making books, and I'm very proud of making books, and I want to keep making books.
If someone could animate your drawings and keep the various shades and the detail, oh my, I'd love to see that film.
That's very interesting. I wouldn't mind seeing that film either.
So let's assume you have more books in you.
Let's. I do. I don't have a lot of ideas. For a long time, I mostly illustrated books that other authors wrote, and that was really wonderful because it was ideas that I never would have known about. And so I got to bring my artwork to these really fascinating stories. And in terms of my own work, I would have an idea every couple of years, maybe. Luckily, the ideas that I do have take a long time to fulfill. They're big ideas that I have to work really hard at. So the one idea that I have every couple of years takes up my time. But I do have an idea for my next book. I know where it's going to be set. I know the country. I basically know the time period. I know a lot of the characters. I do know some of the themes I'm going to be exploring. I've already written up the first chapter and sent it to my editor. And so I'm really excited to be, you know, back doing what it is that I do, which is making up another story.
And are you continuing to do the same thing, finding something yet bolder to do?
Well, the one thing that I haven't figured out for the next book is why or how it's going to be illustrated. You know, I had the movies for Hugo. I had Deafness and Deaf Culture for Wonderstruck, for the justification for the images. And the one thing I don't have yet is why this story that I've come up with is going to be illustrated. And I had this really radical idea that maybe I would write a book that was just words. You know, other people do it. And so I thought maybe I could write a novel that's just text. And I said this idea to my editor, and she looked at me and she was like, no, you're going to illustrate your next book. So I feel like I really do want to illustrate the next book. And I don't think I want it to be much longer than Wonderstruck. Wonderstruck is 100 drawings longer than Hugo. But I have a feeling the next book is going to be a really big, long illustrated text. Again, I don't know how the pictures are going to work in the plot, but I have a feeling it's going to be big. And I like the idea of there being three books that have something to do with this kind of structure. And I have a feeling that after that third book, it will be time to really try to find something different. Although I don't have any idea what that is, and I'm just trying to figure out the plot right now of the next book. So that's sort of how I picture three, you know, three is always a good number.
But you're partial to the words for the next one, so it's not a graphic novel.
Well, I think it is going to end up being illustrated with sequential images, not unlike Wonderstruck in some fashion. But I do always start with words, even though I think in pictures. So I see these images. So, but yes, I for the next story, right now, what's developing in my head is the plot and the characters, and there's a family that I have to make up four or five generations for. So I've been writing up their generations, and yeah, and right now it's just text. But by the time it comes out, hopefully within 3 or 4 years, it will be illustrated in some fashion.
and we'll talk about that.
All right. I'll be around, and I'll look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. It was really wonderful to talk to you.